Hello and welcome back to the Classics Podcast. And I'm delighted to be joined again by our expert in residence, Han Parker. Han's here for part two of our interview, and this is the Q&A section. So thank you all very much for sending in your questions for Han, which we've received from email, from social media, both on ours at the Classical Pod and from Han's at historical underscore Han on TikTok. And it's a delight to have her here again today. How are you doing, Han?
I'm really well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. I'm really looking forward to answering these questions.
Fantastic. Well, it's great to have a part two. All good things should have a part two. We've had so many questions and loads that we want to get through today. So we're going to start with one that was actually a really common question that came up from lots of people because they were really intrigued to know, out of all of ancient mythology, which is so vast and interesting, which is your favourite myth?
Yeah, so I feel like I'm going to disappoint people here. It's the myth of Diana and Actaeon. So Diana was the Roman equivalent of Artemis. She was the virgin huntress goddess. And Actaeon was this handsome young hunter who wanted to peek at Diana having a bath in the woods. And unfortunately, she saw him, or fortunately, and sent his dogs on him. And so he was unalived. But the reason I like it is not because of the story, which is also an interesting angle to look at myth, because I prefer looking at how it was represented in art, specifically in ancient art. And it's one of my favorite myths because of how it's depicted in these beautiful paneled paintings in the Bicolinium at the house of Octavius Curtio in Pompeii. And it's so wonderful. You see on the one side, you have Actaeon, and in the other portrait panel, you have Diana. And it's just the moment she's catching him, looking at her bathing. And I just think it's such a magical piece of artwork. And that house isn't another one that you should definitely look at if you're interested in ancient art, especially in Roman art.
Thank you. Well, that we got so many recommendations all there within one answer. And another question people asked was about where they should maybe start if they're looking into the ancient world for the first time, where they could particularly visit. I'm guessing Pompeii would be on your list of recommendations, but do you have some others for us as well?
Yeah, so definitely Pompeii, but no one needs to hear me shout about that. I think the top other places that I would recommend are Athens in Greece, because there's so much there for you to do. There's the Parthenon, which is just the most incredible place to visit. I mean, standing there and having the sunset go down, you're seeing the Caryatids in the sunset, and it's just an incredible experience. I think Athens is one of those places that so many historians' souls feel at home. It's just so wonderful. And of course, Rome has such wonderful history that begins in the ancient world, but that classical inspiration has continued. And with the Renaissance, it's just got the legacy of classics is so alive. And every corner you walk around in Rome, there's something to discover. Those are the two sort of defaults, I would say. But my heart lies in the south of France. If you want to go see some incredible Roman ruins, my favorite city is Nîmes. So that's where I would recommend, off the beaten track a bit if you've never been to France, but that's where I would recommend going. There's so much to see.
And what are some of the highlights specifically in Nîmes?
So they have so it's actually called France's Rome because it's got the seven hills. It's got the Arène de Nîmes, and I'm not pronouncing that properly, but the arena, the amphitheater, and it's very well preserved. You can go in and they do festivals and they do performances. And when I was there in the summer, I go every year. They have people dressed up as gladiators, like shouting across to each other. They have this amazing Tour de Main, the large tower. They have the Maison Carrée, which is one of the best preserved Roman temples in the world, and it was dedicated to Augustus's grandsons. But yeah, it's wonderful. It's definitely an amazing place to go. And you get one ticket and it gets you into everything, and better price than Rome or Greece.
Fantastic. We love to know the hidden gems. Talking of the trips that you've been on, and I know you've been to many, both in your personal life and also in your working life, which is the best trip that you've been on with your historical work that you've enjoyed the most? Aside from Nîmes, you can't pick Nîmes.
I can't pick Nîmes for everything. I would say that although it was a experience going to Italy on my own in the summer when I was on a campaign for Visit Europe, my highlight was I had 2 days that I went to San Marino. It's the fifth smallest country in the world, and it's landlocked on in northeastern Italy. And it's literally, this whole country is on a mountain, and it was founded by a man called Saint Marinus, so Marinus, and he was from Croatia, and he was this Roman Croatian man who founded his own place, and they have they know what stone like he lay down on supposedly when he slept there for the first few nights, and they've got his relics still in the cathedral. And it was just such an interesting trip because I didn't know anything about it, and I went in completely blind, and I actually saw such rich history that they're so proud of today. And they've got these incredible paintings. It's just a wonderful place to go, and it's very small. You could spend like a weekend there. But that was my best trip, and everyone was just so friendly, and the food was great. It was all like Italian food. Lots of nice wine, pizza, pasta. It's great.
Sounds absolutely idyllic. Imagine also having a country named after yourself and just going out and discovering it in that way, you know. His Parkersville, Parker Town. Now, we had an interesting question here, which was about pets. So the question was, did people in the ancient world have pets in the same way we do?
Yes, they did. They love their pets. They love their cats and their dogs, just as we do today, really. I mean, the concept of guard dogs is not something that we have so much in the Western world today, but it was rife in the ancient world. But that didn't mean that they weren't loved pets. So obviously we all know the Cave Canem from Pompeii, you know, beware of the dog. But I reckon that that dog was getting belly rubs at the end of the day too. We have wonderful sort of funerary inscriptions that tell us about how much people cared about their pets. So for the Romans, and there's also some in what is now Turkey, there was a woman, I'm not sure where this example comes from. I think it might be the one from Turkey where she had a little lap dog. I think her name began with an R-H-O, I'm not sure. And she was talking about how much she loved her dog. And there's also one about a man whose dog he describes as a daughter. And another one who he described, he's talking about how sad he was, how he's weeping, carrying the dog to its final resting place, just as he remembered bringing her home when she was a puppy. So, you know, people did love their pets. And it wasn't just, you know, for Roman Greece. People in ancient Egypt, and this is something that people debate on, about how they really felt about their cats. But if a cat died in ancient Egypt, the whole family would shave their eyebrows off, and they would mourn that pet until they fully grew back. So that's obviously also, cats are very tied into religion in ancient Egypt, but there was that sort of connection with the pets that they shared their lives with, just as we do today. I'm sure that when my cats pass away, and hopefully a long time from now, I'll be tempted to shave my eyebrows off, but I think I wouldn't be over it by the time they grew back.
Well, yeah, we'll be on the lookout, and if anyone has shaved eyebrows like that, to check that their cats are okay, just in case the tradition has continued.
Yeah.
And I guess obviously depending on where you lived in ancient society as well, and the importance of agriculture, then you know, animals were obviously had many different functions and would be there for a productive sense as well, as
yeah.
Horses used in the military, so on and so forth. Now, who is your favorite ancient woman?
So this is a really hard question to ask me, because I've been so fortunate to make lots of videos about loads of incredible women from the ancient world. My favorite, it being Women's History Month, has to be Zenobia, the Queen of Palmyra, the very short-lived Palmyrene Empire. She was incredibly strong, and when her husband died, maybe she had a hand in it, who knows, she just took the throne, and she created a center for culture and for, you know, for poetry, for art. She was a patron of the arts, and she really tried to create a sort of mini Alexandria type situation. And unfortunately, it didn't last very long, and she was, of course, captured. And whether you believe she was executed by Rome, or whether she died in some other way, or whether she was allowed to, I believe my theory that I like to believe is that she just retired at Hadrian's Villa in Tivoli, and that was the end of her. But you know, it probably wasn't that. But she's definitely my favorite. She's an example of, she's one of several examples of strong women that rose against Rome, and they fought for their freedom and for their people. They didn't put themselves first, you know, they literally paid with their lives what they believed in.
Yeah, and there are so many great examples, aren't there, across the Roman world. For example, Cartimandua in Roman Britain, as well as we think of Boudicca as well as being the most famous Celtic queen. But yeah, Zenobia is a brilliant choice.
Yeah. And actually, my second favorite, if I'm allowed to put that in, is Amanerenus from Nubia, from Kush. And she was the Kandake or the Candace of Kush. She was the ruler. And she has been credited with being the reason that Augustus was never able to push south into Africa than he might have wanted. And there's this wonderful story, and you can see it on display at the British Museum at the minute in their Legion exhibition. It's the first thing you see is the Mero head, and it's this beautiful bronzed head of then Octavian, looking very baby-faced with his beautiful inlaid eyes. And her soldiers pillaged it from the Roman camp, and they buried it under the staircase of their temple to freedom. And she was able to walk on top of the emperor to go into this place. So she was another. There were so many of these women that we only ever hear about, sort of like Cleopatra or Boudicca, but there are many out there for you guys to explore and learn about.
That is such a power move as well, being able to literally trample over the head of the emperor.
I know.
Now, I know that your favourite, perhaps on the female goddess side, is perhaps Tyche, and we've spoken about her in episode one. So please go back and have a listen if you haven't already, because Tyche is the focus, and the many different forms of Tyche is the focus of your master's dissertation. And we've had lots of questions about Tyche because I think it's such an interesting topic, and again, perhaps somebody that people haven't necessarily heard very much about before. So one question asked, was Tyche one of the Fates? If so, who were they, and were they the same in the Near East as they were in Greece, for example?
So that's interesting because Tyche, if anybody didn't watch part one, she's a goddess of fortune. The Roman equivalent is, of course, Fortuna. So Tyche isn't a fate. She is a complete separate thing. So in ancient Greece, she is a fortune goddess. So if you, I don't know if you maybe even had an injury, if you wouldn't necessarily go to Asclepius. I hate pronouncing that word. I've seen even in the I was in the British Museum recently, and there are sort of there's this wonderful display of sort of like medical stuff and people asking for help from Fortuna. So it's the same sort of thing, Tyche, Fortuna. She was a way for you to gain luck. But in the Near East, she has a completely different capacity, and which then will trickle down across the empire, where she is a personification of these cities. So after Alexander the Great moves east into creating the Hellenistic world, she was brought as this Greek goddess. And they, in sort of the Near East, they have this local idea of Gad in Syria. So Gad, like we spoke about before, is this idea of protection and personified fortune, sort of the protective spirits. They're like genie, and those sort of ideas were mushed together to create what we had as Tyche. So it was a really interesting mix, cultural mix of local religious belief and this imported Greek goddess. So she's very unique in the Near East. So but of course that then that trickles down into the Byzantine Empire and across the Roman world, we have Tyche as a personification. So she really did take off as a popular figure in the pantheon.
And as well as being emblematic of a particular city, was it also on a much more personal level? In the way the Romans had their sort of lares, their penates, their household gods, was Tyche revered in the home as well as the city?
So that's not something that I'm so sure on, especially because I focus on the Near East. I mostly look at like coins and public spaces, but there are these wonderful tokens from Palmyra, and these tokens have Gad on them. But as we spoke about before, in inscriptions, Gad is considered the equivalent of Tyche. When it's bilingual, it's Tyche in Greek and it's Gad in Aramaic. So these tokens would have functioned as sort of tickets to banquets, that kind of thing. Like they were specific to your family, your tribal group. And those were specific. So they did have this concept of a family protector that they did continue with. So whether it was, Tyche with her beautiful crown, and I don't think, but I think that that concept of having a personal lucky charm, lucky goddess, lucky deity, that definitely was a prevalent thing in the Near East.
You mentioned Aramaic there. If you could go back to the ancient world to a particular place, authentic time, where would you go and which language would you like to speak or learn, be around?
So, to the surprise of, I think, absolutely no one, I would definitely have to say Aramaic, specifically the Nabataean dialect. But I would like to go not to the Roman times. I would like to go to the early days when the Nabataeans were establishing their first settlements. They were a nomadic people originally, and I would have loved to have gone back and seen how they decided to suddenly build these incredible cities like nothing we've ever seen across the ancient world, across the entire world, these beautiful rock cut cities. I would have loved to have spoken to them about where that inspiration came from, because if you look at them, there's classical inspiration, Greco-Roman inspiration. And there's, of course, Egyptian because of the close proximity to Egypt. And I would love to go there and sort of ask the questions about where do you feel like you fit in this world that's so changing? And yeah, I think that would be what I'd want to know, because unfortunately we don't have too much Nabataean stuff. So I'd have to go back and speak to the architects.
That would be fantastic. I mean, they were responsible for at Petra, weren't they? The kind of well, there of the rock, which is so incredible. You've actually written a piece for us, I know, on Nabataean coinage, which is really interesting for our Classical Association members. So do sign up if you'd like to have a read of Han's blog, which tells us a little bit more about some of the particular kings and the way in which they presented themselves on their coinage in comparison, I suppose, to how other client kings across the empire did so. And again, you mentioned Alexander building upon that Hellenistic portrayal on coins, but also retaining something that was a little bit more personal to their style. I suppose if you were asking the architects where this came from, would you also like to meet one of these kings and ask him exactly what he was doing on his coins?
I would love to meet Aratus the Fourth. So he's this incredible figure, really, that he goes against all societal norms, all convention, and he just breaks away. And I would love to go back and say to him, I think that you mean this. Am I right? Am I reaching? Tell me the inside information. I'd love to know. And of course, as you guys will see, if you sign up and read the blog, I want to know how he actually represented himself in real life. Like, did he wear any headdress? Was he wearing his purple slippers but no top? I want to know what he was looking like when he was entertaining at his court in Petra.
If only they had fly-in-the-wall documentaries in those days, would
I
have
know.
been brilliant. Talking of TV, I know that you've been doing some work on TV yourself recently, so tell us what that's been like.
So I've recently been in a couple of episodes of Jimmy Carr's I Literally Just Told You, which is a game show, very Jimmy Carr, very sort of like brash and rude and fun and fast. And I got an email over the summer from a producer, and she said, she called me up and she goes, "You might not want to do it when I tell you what the show is." And I was like, very intrigued. I was like, oh, okay. All I knew was it was Channel 4 at the time. And it ended up being this thing, and I thought, you know what, that might be fun. And I was a bit apprehensive about what TV would be like, because it's so created, it's so curated for people, right? You don't know what it's really like behind the scenes. But honestly, it was such an amazing experience. Everybody was so kind. I didn't have a bad experience whatsoever. If you guys have seen one of the episodes, which I doubt, but if you have, there is a one episode. So I was hired just as a historian, like a fact checker, a question writer. And so I wasn't actually like playing on the game show. And so I was history for everything. And there was a question about World War II. And this is an awful thing to admit, but I don't really know anything about World War II, really. So the producer said to me, they're like, no one's going to ask you a question. Jimmy's not going to ask you to say anything about World War II. Promise. We're in a live studio with like 250 people in the audience. And Jimmy goes, "You got a fact for me, Han?" And I just looked at him like, what? I would have been like a scene in The Office. I just looked at the camera like, I'm not supposed to be asked a question right now. And I gave one, and he goes, "That's a really insert bad word, fact." So the audience is like booing him. It's like very funny. But it was a wonderful experience. I had a great time. Everyone was lovely. And he's a really nice guy at the end of it. He was like, "Oh, you're right." And I was like, yeah, don't worry about it. So it was a great experience. Nothing highbrow like a documentary though, but it was great.
But hopefully one day. Do you have any advice for anyone that is looking to get involved in that world or to vlog and post the videos about history? And that we talked a bit more last time about your kind of journey and how that all came about and the audience that you've grown. But do you have some sort of short form advice for people that you'd give?
Yeah, so I would say consistency is key. That's the first thing you've got to understand, is that you can't just make these amazing things sporadically. My advice would be to batch film if you can, because you're not always going to feel up to it. And I would say really find your own way. There's been, I met up with some historians yesterday who do the same sort of thing. We're talking about how there's quite a surge of new people now, which is amazing. You know, we're getting all these wonderful new voices, but it's difficult when people maybe take too much inspiration and base their entire brand off someone else's who's already established. And I would say that's not going to gain you any favors, because people want to see someone new. They want to see something interesting. Find your own path and you'll attract your people. That's what worked for me, and it's worked for everyone that I know who's made it. So yeah, think about what you're interested in. Think about your strengths and do what you feel is right, because it'll definitely work if you're passionate behind it.
Brilliant advice. And last time we did give a few what's on your bookshelf at the moment, but we also mentioned that people might like to add to their own TBR a book of your own, which will be coming soon. Can you tell us anything about it at this stage?
By soon, we're talking like years from now. The world is so slow, and I am a slow writer, as we know with my thesis.
Yes, I wasn't going to ask you about that. I remember now from episode one, but
don't. Yeah, so it's very, I think the only thing that I can really say about it is it's very on brand with what I post consistently, and it's there'll be, yeah, lots of nice hidden stories. I think I've been saying too much to people that I'm actually supposed to. But yeah, it'll be good when it happens.
okay, insert bleep machine, insert. We'll cut there to ensure that we go no further and reveal more secrets. But that is very exciting. And I know that there will be lots of people listening to this that will be looking forward to that, but no pressure, no rush, whenever that comes to fruition. And so, what have you actually been reading at the moment? I think, do we have an updated recommendations list?
So yes, I have my two books on at the go. I have my nonfiction, which I always try and do something to broaden my horizons with. And that is currently Fall of Civilizations by Paul Cooper. It's based on the amazing podcast of the same name. And luckily I got a proof. So it's actually coming out next month, but it's interesting for me because I don't have so much knowledge on outside of that sort of like Greco-Roman world. And there's stuff from Asia in here, and I'm really looking forward to learning about how these great empires fell, how they sort of like disappeared. So that's my nonfiction. But my fiction, and this is prehistoric stuff, I am a big fan of the very, very old series, Clan of the Cave Bear. And it is brilliant. There's like five or seven books. It's a big series, and they're massive. And I'm on the second book. And it's basically set in like prehistoric Europe, where like 13,000 years ago, there is a human child that is adopted by Neanderthals. And it sort of like follows her life and how she tries to break, well, how she's forced to break away from her community and tries to find humans of, you know, Homo sapiens for her to live her life with her own people. It's brilliant, actually, because the author did such incredible research and really tried to make it as accurate as possible. And obviously, it was written in the 80s, so some of it's a bit dated, but I am really enjoying it.
Fantastic. I've not heard of that series before, so we'll certainly check it out. Thank you for the recommendations. And there have been so many recommendations in this episode, so I hope that you've really enjoyed listening. And thank you again, Han, so much for both episodes and for being our expert in residence. Blog is now live, so members, please go have a look and enjoy.
I'm so thankful that you guys invited me to be your first ever expert in residence. What an honor.
Oh, well, it's been a pleasure and a privilege. Thank you so much.